Accession number 26848, Reel 7.
Mr. Broomfield, Reel 7. We're talking about, we got into routine, but basically we're at the working up trials at Tobermory. Now, one thing we mentioned was the death of this leading seaman, and you mentioned off tape there that you had a Dutch auction. Could you explain what a Dutch auction was?
Yes, the whole of the ship's company were very upset at the death of this seaman, because he was very well liked, and he hadn't long been married. He was quite young, the leading seaman. Anyway, I'd never seen a Dutch auction before, but what happened, his cap and his uniform and his effects were placed on the upper deck, and chaps would bid for them, and once they bought the particular article, it would then be put back into the thing, and the proceeds from this Dutch auction were then sent to the chap's widow, which was just our way of trying to mark the occasion.
Did you buy anything?
No, I didn't actually.
Did you bid? Or
no, I didn't. One of the reasons is that I was only on low money. I was on 3 shillings a day.
Well, can we talk about pay? Tell me about how much money you got and what you'd spend it on typically.
Yeah. I was on 3 shillings a day when I joined up, and that was 21 shillings a week. And I made an allocation to my mother in the mistaken belief that if anything happened to me, she'd get a pension. I found out later that she wouldn't, because she was being supported by my father. But yeah, that meant then that I was actually only receiving, I think, about 14 shillings a week. I think the allotment was 7 shillings. So I had 14 shillings a week. As it happened, once we were at sea, the only thing we would be able to spend our money on was soap. We had to buy our own soap for washing our clothes, or cigarettes, or writing paper, and things like that. So we didn't really have an awful lot of expenses on the ship. And most of the money that we got would go when you were able to get ashore and buy a few beers. But I very often would volunteer to stay on board the ship and let others go ashore in my place, because I was saving up to get married, and I would stay aboard and write letters. So I didn't find that the small amount of money was much of a hardship, but I didn't buy anything.
Now tell me about writing home, and how important letters were, both writing and receiving, and who you'd write to, who you'd get letters from.
When you were off duty, that was my main activity, I think, was writing letters, mainly to my future wife. And I used to write, if I possibly could, at least part of a letter or a letter each day, so that when we came into port and we could post them, I would receive from my wife, who wrote fairly regularly, almost every day, we'd have a bundle of mail to go through, and it was the thing that we all, without exception, all looked forward to, was receiving mail. So if you want to receive mail, you've got to write it, and it was a very, very big factor in my naval career.
Now, what would you write to your future wife and to your parents about?
I found no difficulty writing. I've always been quite good at it, and I just write about my feelings. I couldn't obviously say anything about where the ship was or what we were doing because of wartime secrecy, but there would be mainly personal things, personal feelings, hopes for the future, any little humorous things that happened on the ship, just as if you would talk to somebody if they were there, that kind of thing. I'll tell you a little story about this writing. Very often I would perhaps be up in the wireless office writing, perhaps in the little coder's office, and I can remember being one time in there writing letters with a bunting tosser from Liverpool. And he said to me, I don't know how you can write page after page after page like you do. Of course, he called me Sparks. I would call him Bunce Bunting Tosser. And I said, well, I'd just write, if your girl was here, what you'd say to her. But he wasn't terribly well educated, and he used to say things like, you was, instead of you were, which is very typical Liverpool expression. And I tried to explain to him why you was not the correct grammar. So I took him out into French, showing how you had to conjugate verbs. And while this was going on, a chap who was a midshipman, and he eventually became a sub-lieutenant, came into the office and was listening. And I'd mentioned different tenses in French. And he said it when I paused, he said, oh, very good, Sparks, he said, but you've missed one tense out. And I said, what's that, sir? Because being a midshipman, I called him sir. He said, the superlative. Well, I'm dressed in overalls, well, not in naval uniform, because at sea we used to wear sort of overalls, casual dress. And he doesn't know anything about me. So I said, superlative, sir. And he said, oh, yes. I said, if I've got a good book, what is the word good? And he never said anything. I said, it's an adjective, isn't it? I said, if I've got two books, one's better than the other, the better's the comparative case. If I've got three books and one's the best, what's the word best? I said, it's the superlative. And it relates to adjectives. Tenses relate to verbs, sir. And I never had any further trouble with him. And that is another true story.
Now, you said you used to write, were you very aware of being censored? Can you talk
yes,
about that?
Yes, very, very much aware. All our letters were censored. This particular one I've just told you about, this midshipman, who wasn't a bad sort of chap. We had quite a good relationship, actually. He, at times, would censor my letters. And he probably did most of the censoring because he was a junior officer. And I would very often put in brackets in the letter I was writing to my girlfriend a remark addressed to the censor, sometimes humorous and sometimes perhaps betraying my irritation of the fact that I knew my letter was being censored, which I resented a little but couldn't do anything about it. But that was one of the conditions, that wartime secrecy, your letters were in fact censored.
And what did she write to you about?
Well, she would write and tell me what she was working, and she belonged to a youth club, and she would tell me about different people I knew in London I'd met up with, and more or less what she was doing, and again what she hoped for the future, and looking forward to the next leave when I could get up to London, or we used to call London in those days the smoke. You didn't say we're going up to London, we used to say we're going up the smoke.
So you'd spend your leave with her rather than at home?
Oh yes, I used to go to London, definitely.
Now, what about the question of getting married? I mean, I know you get married in May 1945, but it's not long, but in February, what made you decide to get married? Because you were at war, and there's two angles to it, isn't it? You could have left her a widow. What made you decide to get married?
When I met my wife when I came down to London, and then I left London to go to Scotland, to HMS Scotia, I knew very, very firmly that I wanted to go back to London to see my girlfriend. And I realised then that she was the only person I was really wanting to spend the rest of my days with. And it sort of dawned on me then that this was a very, very strong friendship. I'd obviously taken other girls out before, but this was one that was stronger than anything else that had ever come along. And we then started to make plans for the future. And we got engaged. And we were planning what we would do when the war was ended and how we would set up life together. So a lot of that would feature in our letters back and forth. And that's one of the reasons I stayed on the ship, because I was starting to try and save money for the time when we were going to get married.
So the reason you waited till 1945 wasn't any reason about the war. It was, the real reason was you just didn't have enough money to get married.
That and the war. We had no intention of getting married until I came out of the Navy.
Well, why?
We had no home, we had nothing, really. What happened when the German war finished?
I'm talking about 44.
Now, 44.
I know you get married after the war, but...
No,
what was it that... I mean, were you worried about leaving a widow, or what were you worried about? Why not till the war finished?
I don't think we were in a position to marry at that particular point in time.
Right, okay. So, after Tobermory, you weren't there that long, were you? It seems
no.
to have been there round about March, basically.
Yeah.
And then, according to the history, you went back to Liverpool with 113th Escort Group and did some work in the Atlantic.
That's right.
Is that how you remember it?
Yes, yes.
So when would you go back to Liverpool about April, or was it
Yep, March? Yep.
Now, do you remember being based with... In fact, it says you were commanding, not you, but the ship was the lead ship of the 113 Escort Group. Do you remember that?
Yes.
So what did that entail?
There were normally six ships in an escort group, and they'd have, like, a couple on the left and right of the convoy, one at the front of the back, and they would rotate their positions, and one would be the lead ship. And when ours was made the lead ship, petty officer Story was made a chief petty officer because he was on the lead ship. He was promoted, and I think he was due for a promotion anyway, because he'd had a lot of service. He was a Ganges boy.
And that would mean Commander Grant was the senior officer, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Lieutenant Commander Grant, sorry.
Yeah.
Yep. So tell me what you were doing based in Liverpool. I mean, let's look at the service first. You were mainly on the Atlantic, I believe.
Yes, the Atlantic. I mainly did the Atlantic all the way through up to D-Day. The interesting thing about Liverpool, Devonport and Portsmouth, because we changed from Liverpool to Devonport to Portsmouth. We went to different bases, all doing Atlantic convoys. The interesting thing was that I never, ever got ashore in Canada or America. I've seen the coastline, but never, ever set foot ashore. We just went from our base, be it Liverpool, Devonport or Portsmouth, picked up a convoy, took it across the Atlantic, picked up another one on the way back, and we'd be about 10 days out and a couple of days in harbour, 10 days out, a couple of days in harbour.
Now, what were those 10 days like?
Most of the time, they were fairly monotonous, fairly routine, repetitious. When you're in convoys, there's not an awful lot to see because the speed of the convoy is the speed of the slower ship, and merchant ships fully loaded were only doing about 8 knots, and we would be going faster because we would be moving position. But if you had, say, 20 or 30 or more ships in a convoy, they would be spread across quite a few miles, so you would only see a ship in the distance. And because of the Atlantic rollers, very often you wouldn't see it because the ship would be down in the trough. I mean, some of these waves, when the weather was a bit rough, were 20-foot waves. So the ship would... You'd be going down in your trough, and the other ship would be going down that trough, and you've got a wave of water in between. So one minute you'd see a ship in the distance, and they would disappear. So there wasn't a great amount to see.
Now, what was this rough weather like on board ship? Give us an idea. I mean, there was you're on a ship that rolled. You're a seasick type person. What was it like?
Well, when the weather was nice, it was quite pleasant. But when it was stormy, and as the Atlantic can be, it could be very, very nasty. The ship would be thrown all over the place. And you really had to be careful that things go flying around. You couldn't just put a cup down, it would just go flying. Very often, I mean, because of the cups getting broken, sometimes in the galley, we, from time to time on the ship, this is no leg pull, we would drink out of evaporated milk tins where the lid had been taken off because the cups were all broken. Not a hardship, really, but just something I remember. When we were at doing these particular convoys, particularly when we were lead ship, I used to go up from time to time on the bridge with the officers with a wireless set on my back like a knapsack. And this was a special little radio set with a very limited range, just enough for us to be able to pass messages verbally to some of the other ships in the vicinity, and we wouldn't be using wireless telegraphy, we'd be using plain language. And I had a microphone, and I would be able to speak into the thing.
Did it have a name?
I can't remember the name of it. I know it was strapped on my back with the aerial sticking up, like a portable set.
But how did it work? Tell us how it worked.
Well, what happened there, the captain wanted the escorts to change position or lay a pattern of depth charges or something like that. He would give me the message and I would speak it into the microphone, and if it was a question of moving to different position, I would make sure that the other ships had received the message, and then when he wanted them to activate the particular order, then you'd give the order to activate the order, so they'd all do it at once, you see. And I'd do that sometimes in the dark, in the middle of the night, and with the moon shining across the water. And I remember that was a thing we did on the convoys. But what we were doing is he would be getting messages about U-boats in the area. You may remember that they'd got the Enigma machine, and we were getting, I know this now, but I didn't at the time, we were getting messages about submarine movements, and we would very often drop depth charges because we would believe that there was a submarine about. And when you get in the Aztec giving you sometimes peculiar echoes, you wonder whether you've got one. So patterns of depth charges were very often laid as a precaution. So you'd have different of the escorts would be dropping patterns of depth charges. The reason I've emphasised this, on a convoy, that night after night, you'd have depth charges being dropped. And even though a ship was quite a long way away from you, the impact of those depth charges when you were below the waterline was deafening, because water's incompressible, and even if a ship was several miles away and dropped some depth charges, you would believe that they were just outside the door. And it would be a hell of a bang on the side of the ship, and very often the lights would flicker and different things like that, with the vibration that these depth charges would cause to our own particular hull.
These were precautionary.
Precautionary.
Were the convoys you were on? I mean, the main period of Atlantic convoys, according to this, was before you went on to the ports from the north. Then it seems to imply you're mainly convoying to France. That may not be how you remember it, so we'll come back to
until
that.
Until D-Day, I never went to France at all.
That's right, no, they say
it was Atlantic all the way through.
Yeah, it's Atlantic for the first two or three months. Were the convoys you were on ever attacked?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Yes. They were attacked by submarines and torpedoes. And I remember, my biggest difficulty with this, Peter, is because I was in the wireless office, I couldn't see. And it was only when I was off duty that I could go on the upper deck and have a look around. And the ships were definitely sunk, but I only saw about three myself in the distance where they were on fire and things like that. Never close up. But other chaps who were on watch when I was not able to see, they did see. Yes, we did have...
What could you see with the three you did see? I mean, normally, what would you see?
In the distance, I just could see smoke up on the horizon, and I knew that there was a ship that had been hit.
Would there be any attempt to rescue them, or was that...
Not by us.
And
not at the time that you're talking about.
So, anything else about these?
I can remember when we were attached to Plymouth and Port.
Still at Liverpool.
Okay.
With 113 Escort Group.
Yeah. What else can I?
Remember? What would you do when you got to? Was it Argentu? You never went to shore, did you?
Never.
You just go out and then come back.
Yeah. What we would do is take over from another escort group the other side. They'd take our convoy, we'd take theirs. Or we'd rendezvous somewhere and then come straight back. I was wanting to get ashore, but I never had the opportunity.
How tired would you get on a convoy like this?
Terribly.
Tell me about...
Mainly because we were very often working in two watches. The rest of the ship, very often stokers and seamen, would be in three watches. But because of the number of messages that we were required to receive and the number of staff that we had, we very often had to go into two watches. That's four on, four off. So very often as we left Liverpool, we would go from three watches into two. And you don't get much sleep when you're in two watches.
Well, so 4 hours maximum, isn't it?
Yeah, 4 hours maximum, yeah. Top whack. See, the other thing is that when you're going to go and watch, you're always shaken before you're actually due to go and watch. You've got to get dressed and change over the watch. So if you were on duty at 4 o'clock in the morning, you get a shake at least quarter of an hour before, because you've got to get out of your bunk, get dressed, go up to the wireless office, take over. So you lose a quarter of an hour there, don't you? Yeah. And by the time you come off watch and you change over to your thing, you're not going to get off. When you come off at, say, at 8 o'clock in the morning, you can't get straight into your bunk at 8 o'clock. You're not going to come off down until about quarter past 8, so you don't get a full 4 hours anyway. And if you've got to have a meal in that time, or do some washing, or dobing, or whatever it is, because we didn't use the laundry, you see.
Well, let's talk. You brought a good subject up. Tell me about, how did you wash your clothes?
Right. Dobing is what we called it, and because we didn't use this laundry, I used to wash my clothes in a bucket. I had a bucket. I don't know whether it was my own bucket or whether it was belonged to the ship, and I would go and get one, but I used to have a bucket. And I'd go into the heads where the wash basins were. Midships, there was a washing area. And I didn't wear underclothes. Don't tell a lie, I did. Yes, I did wear underclothes. But what I would do, I'd strip off naked and I would wash the underclothes I was taking off and put clean ones on, so that as far as possible I would wash everything that was needed to be washed. The big problem wasn't actually washing them. I'll tell you this next bit because it's very relevant. Because I was saving up and because I didn't have an awful lot of money and we had to buy our own soap, I remember there was a variety of soap in those days that used to float. I don't know the make of it, but it was white, and it used to float on the top of the bucket of water. And what I used to do, I had a tin can, which I put holes in the bottom, and when I went for a wash, I keep on calling them the heads, but it was the washing area, other sailors would leave bits of soap, and I would pick them up and put them in this can. So when I came to do my washing, I'd have a number of pieces of soap in the bottom of my can. I'd do them up and down in the water, make a lather, and I would wash my clothes. It would save me the bother of buying a bar of soap, money saved.
And would it lather properly?
Yes, it would. Well, I don't know if it was seawater, because I was getting the water from the washing area. It may have been water that the ship, see, Vic would be able to tell you more about that. But no, it would definitely lather. It was all okay. The big problem I had was getting it dry. And I found a place round the funnel of the ship. There was a, round where the funnel was, there was like doors. And when you opened them, they were warm from the funnel. And I had some string, like clotheslines. And I used to hang, say, a shirt or a singlet or a pair of underpants or whatever, a pair of socks. And I would hang them round there. And then later on, I'd go there and retrieve them if they hadn't been pinched. And put them in my locker.
They'd be dry.
They'd be dry, yeah. Nice.